Today, many a slip. A market update for the 19th of June 2021. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, working on this post covering finance and property news with distinctively Australian flavour. Today we're going to look at the US markets and then the Australian market and try and get behind some of the numbers and also look at which segments are moving higher and which aren't. Lots of fragility at the moment that we're seeing, and therefore a level of uncertainty is very high. Stocks fell for the fourth day, wrapping up the worst week for the S&P 500 since February, as the Federal Reserve's surprise hawkishness upended the reflation trade that had dominated markets this year. Commodities such as copper slumped, while the dollar touched a two-month high. The Nasdaq 100 index rose to a record after the Fed meeting with an advance of 1.3%, but it gave back some of those on Friday. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which is a proxy, I guess, for the so-called value shares, fell more than 500 points as investors stepped back from trades tied to expectations for hot economic growth and inflation. Even safe harbour big cash-spewing technology companies like Apple were lower, pushing the Nasdaq 100 down from a record high. And yields on shorter maturity treasuries jumped after St. Louis Fed President James Bullard said that the central bank has started discussing scaling back the pace of pandemic bond buying. The reverse rotation is continuing, said Giorgio Caputo, senior fund manager at Hambro Capital Management. At a certain point, a hawkish Fed isn't good for anyone, even technology shares. But just a month ago, the shares of faster-growing tech companies were being pummeled amid fears that hot inflation readings would push interest rates higher. While consumer prices did indeed jump, interest rates actually have fallen as investors bet that the inflation surge will be short-lived. That's made expensive but more promising companies like software makers attractive again. A Goldman Sachs basket of software stocks that trade for at least 8x sales is at the highest in 3 months after a rally of 27% since May 13th. And mega-cap favourites like Facebook, Alphabet and Microsoft are back near records after gains over the same span. The resilience underscores the conviction among fund managers with long-term time horizons that the prospects for tech's growth remain bright as the reopening of the US economy continues to gain steam. These companies have strong business models and the tailwind of mega trends from the pandemic that have only gotten stronger, said Ciara Malik, Chief Investment Officer for Global Equities at Nuveen, which has $1.2 trillion in assets under management. That's why they demand a premium. Some of the stocks with the highest valuations have rallied the most over the past month. For example, infrastructure software company Cloudflare, which trades at 51x projected 2021 sales, and DocuSign, the electronic signature company priced at 26x estimated sales, are both up more than 50% since the middle of May. The prevailing belief on Wall Street continues to be that the spike in inflation will be brief. A recent Bank of America survey of fund managers found that nearly three quarters don't expect elevated inflation to be long-lasting. That's alleviating concerns that rising interest rates would kill demand for tech stocks, which have priced in a lot of optimism about growth in the distant future. We're clearly at the time frame where human beings are getting paid more, but I don't believe that's going to spiral upwards out of control, said Kim Forrest, Chief Investment Officer at Boketh Capital Partners. Old guard dividend-paying technology companies, which outperformed this year amid a rotation into value stocks, have lost some of their luster recently. Database software company Oracle, which boasts a 1.7% dividend yield, tumbled this week after a disappointing earnings report. Now it's down 10% from the 8th of June. More broadly, the Russell 1000 Value Index lost nearly 5% in 2 weeks. Companies like HP are still benefiting from high demand for personal computers, but in the long run, growth at many of these more mature companies will cool, according to Daniel Morgan, a senior portfolio manager with Sunovos Trust Company. He said he's been adding to positions in companies like software maker Adobe that are poised to expand at a faster clip and generate high profits over the longer term. But of course, not everyone is blasé about inflation. JP Morgan Chase Chief Executive Officer Jamie Dimon said this week he's preparing for more inflation and higher interest rates. And hedge fund manager Paul Tudor Jones said that if he were on the investment committee of a pension fund, he would have as many inflation hedges on it as I could possibly get. Despite the recent gains for fast growers, many tech stocks remain cheaper than they were early in the year, thanks to improved profits. The average price-to-earnings ratio on the Nasdaq 100 stands at 37, down from a high of more than 40 in February. And markets that are clearly benefiting from the reopening are seeing a pullback, with copper registering its worst week since the start of the pandemic. At the close in New York, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 1.58% to hit a new one-month low, while the S&P 500 index declined 1.31% and the NASDAQ composite declined 0.92%. The volatility index, which measures the implied volatility of the S&P 500, was up 16.62% to 2070. Oil posted a fourth straight weekly gain, even after slipping from the highest level since 2018. Crude oil for delivery in July rose 0.7% to hit $71.54 a barrel. An advance in the dollar this week has made commodities that are priced in US currencies more expensive. Gold bulls suffered their worst week since the 2020 COVID outbreak, as prices fell almost 6% on the Federal Reserve's expedited timetable for rate hikes and stimulus tapering. Gold was at $1,764 on Friday, and that's 0.59%. For the week, the decline was $110, or 5.9%, and that's the biggest drop since the week ended March the 6th in 2020. The Federal Reserve signalled at the end of its monthly policy meeting on Wednesday that it would raise interest rates at least twice by the end of 2023 to 0.6% from the current levels of 0 to 0.25%. And the Fed also said it was looking for the date on which it would start tapering its monthly asset purchases of $120 billion. The central bank has been buying at least $80 billion in treasury bonds and $40 billion in mortgage bonds to support credit markets and the economy since the COVID-19 outbreak last year. The well-expected moves still managed to generate more market panic than necessary, sending the previously battered dollar index rallying on the rate hike expectations and hammering commodity prices in the currency, including gold. Bears and the yellow metal loaded up massively on shorts a day after the Fed's announcement, despite US weekly job claims on Thursday that's been supportive to gold. And adding somewhat to that pressure on gold was the St. Louis Fed President James Bullard's observations on Friday that the central bank might have to consider raising interest rates by next year instead of 2023, as inflation could run ahead of its expectations. Bullard, of course, is a non-voting member of the Fed, but a senior one whose comments often reverberate across markets. The reflation trade is no more, and this selling across commodities could see further short-term pressure with gold prices. When the Australian Bureau of Statistics announced on Thursday a spectacular unemployment rate of 5.1% for May, one coalition staffer joked that Scott Morrison, who was flying home from Europe, should divert his plane straight to Yarralumba and call on the Governor-General. The view being that, as the economy roared back, maybe an election this year would be a good idea. Rarely does an interview or a press conference go by without the Prime Minister insisting the election will be next year. Yet, such is the scepticism which abounds in politics that the more he says it, the more his foes believe otherwise. "We've got a lot of work to do," said a senior Labour member, referring to the five-week parliamentary winter break that begins at the end of next week. Labour will use the period to nail down its final position on the Stage 3 tax cuts and finalise policy announcements on Anthony Albanese's strategy for kicking with the wind in the final quarter. Whenever Morrison calls the election, Labour is operating on the basis that it must be ready to go in the second half of this year. Morrison's clear and stated preference is to wait until next year, but like all prime ministers, he will go when he has the best chance of victory. The two most significant determining factors will be the economy and the vaccine rollout. The former suggests the theory of going early, the latter perhaps offers a note of caution. But beware, employment is not as it seems. CBA's Gareth Aird points to the ABS series, The Labour Market Account, which includes non-resident workers. And this tells quite a different story from the headline. In fact, the broader Labour Market Account finds that in March 2021, employment was actually 2.1% below its level 1 year prior. The reason, the exodus of non-resident workers out of Australia. Between December 2019 and March 2021, the number of non-resident workers slumped by 333,900. These non-resident jobs are not counted in the ABS Labour Force survey, yet they have to be filled. So employers have been hiring locals. In other words, there are 333,900 new jobs that were not caught in the Labour Force survey, which are now being caught. And why the jobless rate in regional markets, where many non-resident workers are, declined much more quickly to be below pre-pandemic levels in contrast to the cities where the unemployment rate remains higher. If borders open and non-resident workers return and take those jobs, the unemployment rate would increase from around 5.1% to around 7.5%. In other words, the numbers are technically correct, but totally misleading. In fact, it was only 9 months ago, in the lead-up to the October federal budget, that the Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, announced a new fiscal rule under which budget repair would be put on hold until the unemployment rate fell comfortably below 6%. The budget forecast at that point could be reached in 2023-24. However, in the lead up to this year's May budget, Frydenberg shifted the goalposts again. With economic recovery and jobs growth going gangbusters, he said budget repair would not start until the unemployment rate had a 4 in front of it. Citing new Treasury estimates, Frydenberg said the unemployment rate deemed necessary to see inflation and wages accelerate had fallen below the previous estimate of 5% to between 4.5 and 5%. The May budget forecast that point would be reached in 2022-23. After Thursday's numbers, if you take them at their top level, the expectation inside Treasury and the Reserve Bank of Australia is that unemployment will have a 4 in front of it sometime this calendar year. But of course, that's a fey number, as I've explained. Wages increases, something which has eluded policymakers for more than a decade, could start to materialise, maybe. You could start to get wage rises when you get competition for labour. And what I said in a speech ahead of this year's budget was that the unemployment rate really needs to be around 4.5 to 5% before you start to see that upward pressure on wages, Frydenberg said. This is a very good sign that the economy is recovering strongly, he said. Our political opponents said that the sky would fall in and the world would end, as we knew it, with the end of JobKeeper. Well, that didn't happen. At the same time, the government envisages inflation to stay below 2% well into next year, which is well below the Reserve Bank's target of 2 to 3% that it uses to raise interest rates. Economist Saul Estlake says, as spectacular as the current economic scenario is, it is in the large part a product of Australia's closed borders, a system he deems protectionist and unsustainable beyond the short term. He says Australia's current closed border approach of lock 'em in, lock 'em out and lock 'em up, which is stricter than any other comparable nation, has resulted in Australians spending $55 billion a year on renovations and domestic consumption that they would have otherwise spent overseas. Going next year means keeping the borders closed until then. While that, as Escalate points out, guarantees a buoyant economy, it will result in growing pressure from businesses, expats and tourism to open up sooner. Morrison must weigh this up against keeping the borders shut, which is still very popular in the polls. His initial eagerness to open up the borders was tempered when he saw the way the state governments were handsomely rewarded for a fortress approach. And amid sky-high property prices, the CBA said it will adopt a stricter assessment of the capacity of some borrowers to repay their home loans at higher interest rates After increasing interest rates on its fixed-rate mortgages over the past few months, Commonwealth Bank provided another indication on Friday that lenders are preparing for official rates to rise from record lows. CBA raised the interest rate floor on which it assesses home loans to 5.25% from 5.1%. That is just below Macquarie's 5.3%. The higher floor could reduce the borrowing capacity on a $500,000 loan by around $7,500. A day after the Reserve Bank governor said regulators were preparing for what might happen if housing credit growth accelerated, CBA said that from Saturday, its floor would be 15 basis points higher. Its interest rate buffer would remain unchanged at 2.5%. APRA requires banks to ensure that customers can repay at 2.5% more than their current interest rate or the rate floor set by the bank, whichever is higher. The floor used to be set by the prudential regulator. The assessment of most loans is done using the buffer rate. The CBA standard variable rate is 4.27%. Adding 2.5% to that means many customers are assessed on whether they can repay an interest rate annually at 6.77%. CBA said many of its borrowers are not at that capacity and expected only 1.3% of new home loan applications to be hit by the higher floor. We've taken into consideration the ongoing affordability for our customers during the life of their loan, as well as any potential changes the customer may incur, it said in an email to mortgage brokers. CBA has been growing much more strongly in mortgages than its competitors, around three times as fast as the average of the system. CBA's home loan floor is now higher than the other three banks. ANZ is at 5.1%, Westpac is at 5.05%, and the NAB is at 4.95%. And they're also considering how to respond to a letter from APRA, as reported by the Council of Financial Regulators on Thursday, which asks the boards of major banks to pledge that they're maintaining lending standards. The CFR also wants banks to pay attention to high levels of household debt, as well as policy options that could be deployed to address those risks. So to the Australian markets. In Australia on Friday, the ASX 200 gained 0.13% and was up 0.8% across the week. The big banks led the weekly gains, though they fell back on Friday. CBA gained 2.3% to 103.69. Westpac firmed 2.2% to 26.88. NAB added 1.5% to 26.87. And ANZ climbed 2.6% to 28.98. But a different story on Friday, with CBA down 2.1% and NAB down 0.52%. Tech was the best performing sector in the local markets this week, extending a strong performance through June following a disappointing start to the year. Afterpay climbed 10.5% to 114.40, Xero climbed 6.1% to 142.25, and Zipco climbed 13.8% to $8.14. Healthcare stocks were also among the top performers, with CSL up 3% to 305.52, ResMed added 12.5% to 31.91, and Sonic Healthcare went up 6.2% to 37.81. The losses were led by the major miners, as commodity prices were hit midweek by the surprise hawkish US Federal Reserve. BHP Group dipped 5% to 123.47, Rio Tinto fell 1.2% to 123.47, and Fortescue Metals declined 3.4% to 22.42. Gold miners were among the worst performers, as the precious metals tumbled after the two-day meeting of the Federal Reserve. Newcrest Mining fell 8.4% to 25.96, Northern Star Resources dipped 13.9% to 9.90, and Evolution Mining declined 8.1% to 4.67. The local volatility index, which measures the implied volatility of the S&P ASX 200, was down 3.2% to 11.39. And finally, Michael Burry, who became a household name after his winning bet against mortgages as featured in The Big Short, issued a series of tweets on Thursday warning individual investors about losses the size of countries in the event of crypto and meme stock declines. All hype and speculation is doing is drawing in retail before the mother of all crashes, Burry wrote on Twitter before his posts were deleted. When crypto falls from trillions or meme stocks fall from tens of billions, hash Main Street losses will approach the size of countries. History ain't changed. Burry, the head of Scion Asset Management, is closely followed by the meme stock crowd. He took a bullish stance on video game retailer GameStop Corp in 2019, which helped lay the foundations for an epic retail investor frenzy earlier this year. His views have switched this year, though, to warnings about dangers in the market. If I put dollar GME on your radar and you did well, I'm genuinely happy for you, he wrote in a tweet in January. However, what is going on now? There should be legal and regulatory repercussions. This is unnatural, insane, and dangerous. Burry has a haphazard relationship with Twitter. He doesn't post frequently from his account, but when he does, his comments can be controversial. Last spring, he wrote on the social media platform that lockdowns intended to contain the spread of COVID-19 were worse than the disease itself. He has a habit of deleting his tweets soon after posting them, and earlier this year, the investor told his followers that some of his Twitter activity had triggered a visit by the US Securities and Exchange Commission. Burry isn't alone in his recent warnings about the cryptocurrency space. Mark Cuban, a billionaire owner of the Dallas Mavericks and an early crypto adopter, revealed to his Twitter followers this week that he'd been hit by the drop from roughly $60 to $0 for the DeFi Titanium token, part of a stablecoin project called Iron Finance. There should be regulation to define what a stablecoin is and what collateralization is acceptable, Cuban wrote to Bloomberg News in an email. And as for Burry, he's also placed a bet against Elon Musk's Tesla. Scion Asset Management owned bearish puts against 810,000 shares of the electric car maker as at March 31st, according to a regulatory filing. And did you know that Burry, who was played by Christian Bale in the film version of Michael Lewis's best-selling account of the 2008 financial crisis, The Big Short, was actually originally a doctor? After gaining his MD at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, he was an early adopter of discussing stock trades on online message boards and switched to professional investing. And join me on Tuesday's live show when I'll be joined by investment manager Tony LaCantra from Alto Capital, based in Perth, where we'll be discussing the latest developments of the markets. There is certainly a lot to discuss. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.